From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. Here's what's happening. Well, President Barack Obama has explained his decision not to release photos of Osama bin Laden's corpse this week by simply citing the risk that jihadist militants would use the gruesome images as a propaganda tool. What's more, the president noted that such risks far outweighed the value of producing evidence of bin Laden's death to win the skeptics over. And one notable group won't be counted in that skeptics camp, Al-Qaeda. The terrorist group's general command sent a defiant statement to jihad online forums confirming that bin Laden is dead and calling for his supporters to take revenge. They say that bin Laden's blood will be a curse that will chase the Americans and their agents, a curse that will pursue them from inside and outside their country. And soon, with God's help, it goes on to say, we pray that their happiness turns into sorrow and may their bloods mix with their tears. Strong words. Holed up in a compound in Pakistan, bin Laden was scheming how to hit the United States again, apparently. According to newly uncovered documents that show Al-Qaeda's plans for derailing an American train on the upcoming 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Robert Young Pelton has become the inspiration and role model for a new generation of intellectual adventurers. He's an author, journalist, and filmmaker as well, trained as a Navy SEAL in survival, and here he is for a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, what's your take on all this?
Well, I think bin Laden was an anachronism. I mean, he's no more relevant than Che Guevara or some other people that have passed through time. And the fact that he had to spend from 2005 until today without moving from that house kind of explains his relevance in the terrorism world.
He's pretty ineffective, wasn't he?
Yeah, and you know, he's an image, he's a role model, and I'm sure he'll be more famous in death than he was in life. But his time was past, as you saw in the Middle East with the changes there. He had no effect on the cataclysmic changes in the Arab world. So he was basically an old artifact.
What happens next, Robert? Who's in charge?
Well, we have a lot more problems to deal with in other areas besides Afghanistan and Iraq. We have sort of franchises of Al-Qaeda in Yemen. We have them in Somalia, Maghreb. And those people are going to continue to fight. But essentially, we're on the downward slope, which is the good news. We're sort of on the home stretch here to get rid of this thing that popped up in the mid-90s.
And the hunt's underway, too. We're still after people with Al-Qaeda, aren't we?
Yeah, the interesting thing is, you know, we can exploit the information that was gathered by the SEALs in this raid. And we've sort of broken the back of the network. So I think you'll see people like Zawahiri, Alaki, and people like that slowly start to be captured and killed and removed from the planet.
And I don't think it'll stop. Robert, thanks so much. When our soldiers raided bin Laden's compound and killed him, they found plans, of course, for future attacks. After Hitler died, hidden tunnels in Germany hid some of those plans, too. Hitler wanted to create a fleet of flying saucers similar to today's drones to use as weapons, capable of destroying London and New York. During World War II, many U.S. and British pilots saw these saucers. Some of them were called Foo Fighters, and they assumed they were German weapons. Maybe that's when we got in the habit of shooting at them. A German engineer, Georges Klein, claimed that two types of flying discs had been created by the Nazis. And an engineer, Joseph Andreas Epp, who served as a consultant, said 15 prototypes were built. At the end of the war, over 120 German rocket scientists, including Wernher von Braun, who later went to work at NASA, were invited to the U.S. and the Soviet Union to work on their own missile programs. Georges Klein claimed that he saw Nazi saucers' first manned flight in February of 1945. When it climbed to 40,700 feet and reached 1,400 miles an hour. Close allies of Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, have been accused now of using supernatural powers to further his policies amid an increasingly bitter power struggle between him and the country's supreme leader. Several people said to be close to the president and his chief of staff have been arrested in recent days and charged with being magicians and djinns. Bits and pieces, the famous Halley's Comet will light up the overnight sky in a promising meteor shower, weather permitting, wherever you live. The annual Eta Aquavid meteor shower will peak early and is expected to put on a dazzling display of shooting stars. An Oregon woman who underwent amnesia for oral surgery a year and a half ago woke up to find that she looked the same but sounded very different. She had developed foreign accent syndrome. Karen Butler, who lives in Butler, Oregon, said that she sounded like she was from Transylvania, and it softened a little over time, but she still has not recovered her original Northwestern tone. Doctors diagnosed Butler with foreign accent syndrome, a neurological condition that has only been documented 60 times in the last 100 years. Up next, we're going to be talking about Roswell, USA, towns that celebrate UFOs, lake monsters, Bigfoot, and other weirdness. Get ready. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Two guests for you for a couple hours tonight. First of all, Noe Torres. He's back on Coast to Coast, active member of the UFO research community with many years of experience as an investigator, author, lecturer. Noe has traveled extensively while conducting research. He's spoken at various conferences, including the Roswell Museum's annual UFO Festival, the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas, and, of course, the Bay Area UFO Expo. Noe, welcome back.
Hey, George, it is delightful to be on your show again, and I send you the warmest greetings from MUFON of South Texas.
Super. And, of course, John LeMay, born and raised in Roswell, New Mexico, where he grew up among the aliens. John has met many witnesses around town, giving him a very unique perspective over other authors who've written about Roswell. John is an archivist and the youngest member ever of the board of directors for the Historical Society for Southeast New Mexico in Roswell. Here's our friend John LeMay, first time at Coast to Coast. John, welcome.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me on the show.
Me too. I'm looking forward to this. Both your microphones are up, so feel free, both of you, to jump in at any time. Noe, let me start with you, though. You and John have written this book called Roswell, USA. Tell me about this. Well, how did this start?
Okay, well, John LeMay helped tremendously when I was putting together my book, Ultimate Guide to the Roswell UFO Crash, which we published last year.
Right.
And in putting together that book, I connected with John. It was recommended by several folks in the Roswell area that I contact him because of his knowledge of the history of the area, and also the fact that he has access to a lot of historical documents and photographs in his position with the Historical Society there. So John assisted greatly, and in fact, all of the historical photographs in my Ultimate Roswell Guidebook came courtesy of John through the Historical Society for Southeast New Mexico. And then he went on to help us with our walking tours of the old Army base at Roswell that we did last summer during the UFO Festival. And John was with us and even took part in those tours as well. So he and I connected, and shortly thereafter, we started talking about launching off on a new book project. And eventually, over the course of time, that developed into Roswell, USA, which is John's brand new book. And it turned out really well. We're very happy.
John, what is it about Roswell that has captured our imagination for so long?
Well, it's just the most famous instance of a UFO crashing, you know what I mean? And it's just, I think it has the biggest body of witnesses, and that's the most important thing. And it's just gotten the most exposure.
Do you still live out in that area, John?
I do. I've never left Roswell.
How many witnesses are still alive from the original sighting?
Ooh, not very many. No. Noe could give you a more accurate count. I know one secondary witness just passed away a few weeks ago, and I attended his funeral, John Tilley. I'm just not sure how many. I couldn't really give you an accurate count. You might have to ask Noe about that.
What's left out there, Noe? How many people?
I would be surprised, George, if we have more than 20 original eyewitnesses, people who served at the air base in the 40s, folks that became aware of the story back when it was happening. I would say there's probably not more than 20, and that's an amazingly small number when you consider that hundreds of people have come forward over the past 20 or 30 years to talk about their involvement and the things that they witnessed there when the UFO incident happened. So the list is definitely dwindling, and there's a number of witnesses that have been reticent to come forward with their own testimony. And UFO researchers know that they were involved, and we know that they have a story to tell, but unfortunately they've chosen to not come forward. We're hoping that perhaps toward the end of their lives, they will finally speak about what they saw.
Is the old Undertaker, Glenn Dennis, still around?
He's still alive, but I don't know what he's doing right now.
Yeah, he was a great witness at the time as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was very nice to me. I remember I met him as a young boy at the UFO Museum and talked to me for quite a while and autographed my pamphlet, so certainly a very nice guy.
Let's review just a little bit the strange story about a surviving alien possibly being shot by guards at Roswell. What is this story?
Well, you know, I had mentioned going to the funeral of John Tilley, and he's the one who brought that story to my attention. I would say that probably didn't happen. I think that's kind of like folklore that grew out of the real story that there was a surviving alien. There's really only three witnesses to that story, and none of them, I say witnesses, but none of them are really like a firsthand witness. The story is that in the chaos of the base, you know, the base was just in total disorder that night when they brought the craft in and the bodies. They had so many people going in and out of the base. The story goes that somehow one of the aliens slipped away, and it wandered outside of the base, and apparently it was peeking into the windows of some homes that were located just out of the base gate. I think there was a small trailer court and things like that. And at some point it wandered back to the base gate and was shot by two guards.
Did they apparently kill him?
Yes, yeah, that's the story, is that they killed it. But, of course, there's a ton of different stories about what may or may not have happened to that survivor. You know, you get stories that supposedly it was dissected in a lab. And I think probably what is more believable is that it died from injuries in the crash.
There were reportedly, what, three bodies?
I think there's a lot more than that. The numbers always change. I think there was at least four. I think, what do you think, Noe? More than three?
Well, as John mentions, the body count varies according to different witnesses. I was just listening to some witness testimony from Robert Shirky and others, who indicated that perhaps the number was larger than people originally said. Most people say three or four bodies. The majority of the bodies being deceased, and then one survivor. Most of the eyewitnesses are pretty consistent in terms of there being just one survivor.
Hmm. The files that were released by the FBI under their new vault talked about three craft, not necessarily at Roswell, but three aliens in each one. I found that to be a pretty remarkable document, you two.
There have been a number of documents that have been released under the Freedom of Information Act from the CIA and from the FBI. And the latest document that you mentioned, George, is pretty typical. You know, we don't expect that there's going to be a lot of documentation released at this point, but the little bits and pieces that we see and references to crashed saucers and recovered bodies that we're starting to see in some of these documents are really, really starting to shed a lot of light. When you put it together with all the hundreds of witnesses, for example, all the servicemen who were there in Roswell in 1947, when you start putting together the eyewitness testimony along with some of these documents that are being released by government agencies now, and it kind of starts to put the whole puzzle together for us after so many years.
Was there a second crash at Roswell, but a couple of years later?
Yeah. Let me tell that story. Basically, it's kind of a story of coincidences. And I think it was in the 1980s, Richard Doty released this presidential briefing paper, and it supposedly said that there was a second UFO crash in Roswell in 1949. And then you also have what turned out to be a completely unrelated story, that in 1949, a serviceman at the Roswell Air Base named Raymond Platt, he said he saw something crashing towards the ground out towards Bottomless Lakes east of Roswell. And you can read about that in Kevin Randall's History of UFO Crashes. So basically, I think when people saw these two stories, they assumed that one gave credence to the other. But what I found out about the Raymond Platt sighting was that happened to be on the day of the biggest green fireball sighting of the green fireball wave. Are you familiar with the green fireballs,
yeah,
George?
I sure am.
Yeah. Absolutely. For people that don't know, back in late 1948, people started seeing green meteors in the sky. And the interesting thing was the Air Force actually admitted that they existed. They never tried to cover it up. Their official explanation was basically just that they were unusual meteors. So apparently, though, and on January 30th of 1949, a bunch of people in Roswell and apparently in other states saw this huge fireball streaking across the sky. And so then when people would also read about this Doty paper that was released claiming there was a Roswell crash in 1949, I think they put these two stories together, you know, and they would assume, well, maybe there was a second crash. But I think what it really amounts to is just that Doty's paper was a piece of misinformation. And then that, you know, the other one, the real sighting was basically of a green fireball.
Interesting. Now, you have divided this book into three parts, three
That's
specific
correct.
Areas, and we're going to talk about the subtitle of your book pretty soon because, you know, lake monsters, Bigfoot, and other weirdness in that region I find to be fascinating as well. But you said that there were other strange things about Roswell other than the UFO crash. What do you mean by that?
Well, we have an area east of town called Bottomless Lakes, and, you know, back in the 1970s, that was kind of like Roswell's Lover's Lane. And you remember in the 70s, they had all kinds of crazy stories about the hook-handed man and goat man terrorizing the teenagers in the car. And that was basically Roswell's area for that type of activity. I actually had someone tell me that they had friends that claimed they were attacked out at Bottomless Lakes by a giant wearing a skirt. And there's all kinds of other stories, though, about Bottomless Lakes, about people supposedly drowning in the lakes, and they would end up traveling through underground streams into Carlsbad Caverns. And Carlsbad Caverns is, you know, south of Roswell. So, and that's kind of, no, I don't think anyone's ever proved that that can happen, but that's kind of like accepted folklore. And people also have even believed that a car was driven into Bottomless Lakes and was sucked through this underground channel, and it also ended up in Carlsbad Caverns, supposedly.
Did anybody reportedly get hurt from these creatures?
No, I don't think so. They really didn't have much to go on. You know, it's all secondhand witnesses. I've never met a firsthand witness to any of the supposed Bottomless Lake stories.
Do you think, John or Noe, we will really ever get to the bottom of the Roswell incident?
That's a difficult question, because every time that we seem to be getting closer to the truth, some more misleading information comes out, or witnesses that have testified in the past are suddenly found, you know, their testimony is found to be dubious and perhaps untrustworthy. So it's like an ever-shifting scenario that keeps, it's like a moving target. You never quite can get a handle on it. Our hope, you know, there has been, though, a lot of reliable testimony and a lot of circumstantial evidence that seems to make the overall picture fairly credible for what we believe happened. But as far as actually having that moment when you say, you know, this is it, we have the absolute proof. You know, that certainly has eluded us. And one of the things I know that we'll hopefully have a chance to talk about more tonight is the various crash site scenarios.
Sure. We'll talk about that when we come right back. NOE on Coast to Coast AM. Well, and tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we're talking with NOE Torres and John LeMay, their work, Roswell, USA. And we'll take phone calls with them next hour on Coast to Coast AM before we start open lines. And we shall be right back. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you with NOE Torres and John LeMay. We're talking about their work, Roswell, USA. NOE, tell us about some of the crash sites. Tell me your interest here.
Well, we have gathered together data, of course, for both books, The Ultimate Guide to the Roswell UFO Crash, which John assisted me with, and also his book, Roswell USA, which has an entire chapter on the various crash sites that have been proposed over the years. You know, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, people talk about the Foster Ranch debris field, which is about 100 miles north of the city of Roswell. And that's where rancher Mac Brazel found an entire field littered with metallic debris back in July 1947. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks associate that as with the actual UFO crash site. But as we found out over the years, that was actually a skip site or a bounce site. Apparently, the UFO shed some debris there over the Foster Ranch and then continued traveling for about 40 or 50 miles more, roughly to the east-southeast of the Foster Ranch, before it finally came down in what is known as the final impact site. Now, there has been a lot of research done on the Foster Ranch location. People have been looking for evidence. Of course, we know that the military came in there after the crash and after the object was moved along with the bodies. The military came in and they swept the area pretty efficiently.
Yeah.
They left very little there. But as far as the final impact site, there's very little known about that. And in fact, there's been debate over the years as to its exact location. We do feel, however, that it is in the northern part of Chavez County, which is the county where Roswell is located, as opposed to Lincoln County, which is where the Foster Ranch site is, about 100 miles from Roswell. So the fact that, for example, Roswell City firefighters and policemen later testified that they were at the scene of the final impact site, that would argue in favor of a crash having occurred within the county jurisdiction for Chavez County as opposed to Lincoln. And so it's been a mystery, as there's been several witnesses over the years that have come forward and have proposed different sites for the final impact site. And that remains one of the primary mysteries in this case. Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, whose book Witness to Roswell is probably the best book ever written on the Roswell UFO crash, they have told me that they're pretty certain that they've located the actual final impact site, which they obviously don't want to make public because they don't want a bunch of souvenir hunters out going out to the location and you know, finding stuff to put on
sure.
eBay. But they're fairly they've triangulated and found what they feel is the place where it happened. And as Tom Carey told me recently, you know, there's nothing out there anymore, of course, and it's, you're not going to find, after all these years, if there's any evidence there, it would take an archaeological dig, possibly similar to what's been done over at the Foster Ranch location. However, that remains to be done in the future. So, and John has some additional information about the various crash sites that have been proposed over the years in Roswell, USA as well.
Okay, go ahead, John.
Yeah, well, my main hope was to really just clear up confusion, because a lot of people are confused about this whole impact site thing, because as Noe was saying, the impact site moved around a lot over the years. If you read one book, it'll tell you the Roswell craft crashed on the plains of San Augustine. Another book will tell you it crashed in Capitan. So that's what I really wanted to do, was go over each different crash site and say why that is probably not the one, and the real impact site is most likely, like Noe said, just north of Roswell here in Chavez County.
You know that during these episodes, you know, so many people have, you know, witnessed, seen so many things. I've interviewed a few of them. A few of them have died. Stanton Friedman, of course, being a champion of this episode as well. What are the possibilities? Because I had a story on earlier that Germany was trying to make flying saucers for the war. Is it possible that we could be talking about a craft that we constructed or they did? We were flying it in 47 and it crashed? Or do you still think it's extraterrestrial?
I would go extraterrestrial just judging by the bodies. If people didn't talk about the alien bodies so much, I would say maybe there's a possibility of that Nazi UFO theory. But so many people describe those same bodies with the round heads and the round eyes. I really would have to say that's extraterrestrial.
And you agree with that, Noe?
Absolutely, George. One of the things we do when we take people on our walking tour of the old air base is we stop by the location, the former location of the chapel, where the servicemen at the Roswell Air Base would go, you know, to worship and to reflect on things. And one of the things that's come out of the research done by Tom Carey and Don Schmidt is the turmoil that was going on at the base following the exposure of the servicemen to this strange object and its occupants. And some of the men actually were emotionally and spiritually disturbed, according to the testimony of their families and so forth. And so a lot of them would seek spiritual counseling there at the chapel on the base. And we have later testimony from the family of the chaplain at the time of the 1947 crash, which indicates that something really emotionally wrenching happened. And so going along with what John just talked about, we have so much eyewitness testimony about the strangeness of the beings that were recovered from the crash site. I mean, they were not at all human-like. They were, you know, the description is very clear that they were about 3 to 4 feet tall, and their skin looked nothing like ours, you know, very pale skin, large mm-hmm. heads, deep-set, large eyes, kind of insect-like. In fact, one of the Roswell firemen that went out to the final impact site, Dan Dwyer, and we've interviewed his daughter, Frankie Rowe, Dan Dwyer said that they looked a lot like a certain type of insect that's found throughout the Southwest called the Jerusalem cricket. We have a picture in our book, Ultimate Guide, side by side of one of the so-called alien grays. And then next to it, we have the Jerusalem cricket. And it's amazing how insect, you know, the insect resembles what people think of when they think of ETs. The resemblance is incredible. So the description of the bodies, I agree, would tend to support a non-Earth origin for this craft that crashed.
What's the story behind this alien ghost story? What is this?
Well, as you know, at first, initially, the alien bodies were taken to the old RAF hospital, and the smell was so bad, they had to move them into a hangar. But anyhow, basically, in the 1950s, they built a hospital on the site of the old RAF hospital, and that building still exists in Roswell today as the New Mexico Rehabilitation Center. So that's where people go after surgeries to recover and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And this building has all kinds of ghosts in it, and I've been up there at midnight to interview the different night nurses, and every one of them told me that they've had a ghostly encounter there. And most of them see the ghosts of old servicemen or the ghosts of other nurses and things like that. But one nurse there, this happened in July of 1997, coincidentally, she said she stepped out of the break room and looked down the hall, and there at the end of the hall was a short figure, about 4 feet tall, big round head, round eyes, looked like it was wrapped in silk bandages. And you know, she actually calls it the little man. And it was Jim Mars that discovered that initially when he was here in Roswell and then started calling it the alien ghost. But basically, she only saw it two times, and that was it. But it's still, you know, very interesting story. And as I said, she described it as having the round head and the round eyes and all that.
Are there still UFOs seen over the Roswell area?
I wouldn't say too many nowadays. There used to be quite a few back more in the 1950s, because you know how back in the 50s they had several years that what they called UFO flaps?
Yeah.
They did have quite a few UFO sightings over Roswell during those flap years. And then they kind of tapered off into the 1960s and the 1970s. And I would say pretty rarely today do we have UFO sightings over Roswell.
There's one point I'd like to make about that, John.
Sure.
And George. You know, I'm the section director for MUFON here in South Texas, and in talking to some of my members, one of them made a very simple and yet eloquent statement about society in general today. That people don't look up into the sky as much as they used to. You know, people tend to stay indoors a lot. Our lifestyles have changed. People stay indoors. They don't do as much outdoor activity anymore. And a lot of our focus now is on terrestrial things. I mean, our focus level has changed as a society. And so you have people not looking up into the sky as much anymore. You know, we're used to the droning of airplane engines overhead, even helicopters. And you have fewer people who do stargazing and observations at night. So I think that could be part of the reason. You know, also as a society, I feel we've become a little bit more cynical about seeing strange sights in the sky. So I don't think folks are reporting as much as they would have during this period of time that we're talking about, the 40s, 50s, and early 60s. So those are all factors, I think, in the fact, and when we talk about there seems to be a decreased incidence of sightings in the Roswell area. Probably people just aren't looking as much.
No, probably not. In the subtitle of your book, you also mention Lake Monsters, Bigfoot, and Other Weirdness. Is this all situated near Roswell?
No. My basic idea for the book and the prime focus is how did Roswell's UFO festival influence other towns to kind of follow suit and find something strange in their past that they could promote? And, for instance, the lake monsters in my title would be referring to Lake Champlain. That's where – has everyone heard of Champ, the lake monster Champ probably?
Champy, yeah.
Yeah. So basically Champ is kind of like America's Loch Ness. And Lake Champlain actually spans several different states. So there's a town in Vermont that, you know, promotes Champ as their town mascot. And then there's also a town in New York, in the state of New York, I should say, that also promotes Champ. And there's several other lake monster towns across America. And probably the best town that is the most like Roswell, in my opinion, is Point Pleasant, West Virginia. And that's the town where supposedly Mothman was sighted.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, because they have a Mothman museum there. They have a Mothman festival, a Mothman statue. They've done a really great job of promoting the whole Mothman thing. And probably another good example is Falk, Arkansas. I think everyone remembers the old drive-in classic, the Legend of Boggy Creek,
mm-hmm.
back in the 1970s. And, you know, after that happened, that made the town of Falk famous. And to this day, they promote Bigfoot. So basically, most of my book is just describing towns all across America, you know, East Coast, West Coast, that promote something strange in the vein of UFOs or lake monsters or Bigfoot.
John, do these towns, you know, continue the myth, continue the legend because it's good for tourism, or, you know, do they really care about this? What are they doing?
I really think they do it for the tourism. I mean, I hate to sound cynical, but I think that's just the truth.
Yeah.
I would disagree about Roswell, though, because in many, many visits to Roswell, there seems to be a genuine, still a strongly felt desire to seek out the truth about the Roswell incident. And of course, since it is, you know, the predominant UFO crash retrieval case in history, you know, that stands to reason. But I would say that Roswell is unusual in that way. The annual UFO festival held every July, of course, is there are some elements of it that are kind of hokey and kind of more on the silliness side of things. But as a whole, you have a gathering of major UFO researchers, Stan Friedman, Bruce McAbee, Tom Carey, Don Schmidt, every year that come down there and lecture. And so it has a genuine serious side. And I think there's a legitimate quest for the truth going on there, that some of these other communities, perhaps they don't have that as strong.
I was there for the 60th anniversary in 2007, did a live program out of our affiliate, the KKOB, and then also we went to the event the next day. I had fun out there, Noe.
Oh, it's a fascinating festival. We've been there 6 years in a row, Ruben Uriarte and I. And by the way, Ruben insisted that I say hi to you.
Yes, likewise.
He's very much wanting to get together with you soon, but we're going to be back in Roswell this summer, speaking at the invitation of Julie Schuster, our friend, the director of the UFO Museum in Roswell. So we'll be there speaking this summer. And also E.J. Wilson and John LeMay and myself will be offering the walking tours. We'll be doing 12 tours during the 4 days of the UFO Festival in July. So we're looking forward to that. As you say, it's just a wonderful place to visit and to be able to talk with folks like Stan Friedman and others who make themselves available and make their research available. It's just a fantastic thing.
Well, and what I'd like to know is the genuineness of the people there. They're just great Americans. They're fun people.
Absolutely. In 6 years of spending over a week there every year, I've never had occasion to doubt the sincerity or the genuineness of the folks in Roswell. And we've had nothing but positive experiences there. I've taken my family and friends with me year after year, and everybody has just had a fantastic time. It's such a, despite the fact that it's viewed by many as being kind of a weird fringe thing going on there with the UFO
sure.
Festival. Despite all that, it's a warm, friendly place that really welcomes visitors to their community, and year after year. So we really love it. It's just a great place to go.
I know they gave us the option, Noe, when Tom Danheiser and I were flying there. We landed in Albuquerque, did our program that night. And then the next morning, they wanted us to take a little tiny Cessna to Roswell. And I saw the heaviest clouds I've seen in my life. And I'm thinking of Richie Valens and all those people. And I'm going, nah, I'm not going to do it. So they put us in a car and they took us all the way. They drove us.
I mean, you're going to a place that's already notorious for a crash, right?
Exactly. Why add to it?
You don't want to be the next one.
Why add to it? What's your website for this book?
We have roswellbooks.com is our main website. People can get information there about John's book and our other books, Ruben Uriarte's contributions as well. And then John has a website that's a spinoff off of that called roswellusa.com. So either roswellbooks.com or roswellusa.com. And then we also have a website for our tours called roswelltours.com.
Okay, well, we're going to keep you both for phone calls when we come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Questions about Roswell and other paranormal events, including lake monsters and Bigfoot, where John LeMay can address that, as he has been all over the country. Noe Torres will stay with us as well. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back to take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.